Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today we're talking with David. This is an interesting episode. The markets have been pretty volatile over the last few months, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And David actually retired slash took a sabbatical. We talk about it a little bit, but he stopped working. He's somewhere between Coast Fi and Full Fi, and he decided to leave his job on February 28th of this year. And then the market was especially rocky. He sold about one third of his portfolio, basically at the very bottom of the market. He talks about some of the details, but literally, I think this was the bottom of the market during, you know, the beginning of 2025 here. So we'll talk about his history and getting into FI, of course, but we'll also talk about the decision process to actually sell and if it's really such a bad decision. So when we reason our way into it, it's a pretty rough time to sell. And I think a lot of us can probably relate to like seeing the market go up and down. And the thing is, like, David mentions that he felt like this time was different than other market downturns and that sort of thing. So I appreciate he like sent me the email, he opened up, he's sharing this story. And at the end of the day, I think everything is going to work out just fine. And of course, we talk about what it's like to be retired, at least for the first 3 months or so that he has been retired. So I'm going to give a shout out to Nectarine. If you need any advice, financial advice, but you don't necessarily want to have sort of a big engagement with the CFP or anything like that, basically it's a flat fee, no strings attached. We'll put a link. I'm an affiliate, so I get a commission if you do sign up and end up working there. $150 to $300 per hour, and it's just for the advice. Jeremy Schneider is the founder. He's been on the show a couple times. He's a fun guy. So anyway, if you are in the market for some advice, it's worth checking out, especially if you want to find a fee-only company that you could work with or fee-only advisor that you could work with. So with that said, let's head over to the show with David. David, welcome to the show. I'm pumped to get into your story, and I want to thank you for sharing the situation and the scenario, especially like it's fairly recent and you're still working on it. So welcome to this show and thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here.
So let's hear a little bit about like your background professionally, and people know from the intro that you stepped away from your job and you've had a few months under your belt being, I would say like you're retired right now. Maybe we call it a sabbatical. I don't know, since you may go back to work potentially at some point. But anyway, what's your like financial journey up to this point?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I've spent the last 10, almost 11 years with the same company. We had gone through an acquisition and then worked for the company that bought us, doing the same type of work within the space of benefits enrollment, helping people access public health benefits. I enjoyed the work. I was proud of what we were doing. But, you know, after a decade or so, I felt like it was time for a change of pace, you know, and certainly I'd been following and keeping up with the financial independence media, your show, many other shows and blogs out there, and have been orienting myself in that way, you know, over the years. And of course, we've been through tremendous stock market for the past, I guess, 15 years or so. And so, you know, reached a point, you know, somewhere between Coast Fi and Full Fi, where, you know, I had that comfort to, yeah, decide to take what I'm considering to be a sabbatical. You know, we'll see exactly where it all goes, but a pivot point to take a little break. You know, I have two young kids. It's a great time to have a little extra time and space and energy in my life. You know, and financially, it all made sense. And I'm married, and my wife likes working and is continuing to work. You know, her job doesn't cover 100% of expenses at the moment, because we're in kind of the most expensive time of our lives, likely that we'll have, just with two young children at the time. Yeah, so that's kind of where we're all at. But of course, it's been an interesting time to make that change with what's happening in the markets.
And how old are you?
Just turned 40.
Okay, so about 40. And I mean, like you said, you have young kids, it's a good time to take a break. All this makes sense. I'm curious, when did you first become aware of the FIRE movement? And like you said, you kind of oriented your lifestyle, your savings, and you were aware and conscious of where you were putting your money.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I do remember reading about Mr. Money Mustache in a New Yorker profile, probably about 10 years ago, maybe 2014, so something like that, and thinking that this guy's interesting, but also that, you know, I already felt somewhat aligned in terms of putting away as much as I could, you know, saving as much as I could, not with early retirement or financial independence per se in mind, but just that it seemed like the smart thing to do. And also, I was really enjoying my life. I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything by not spending much. You know, my wife and I lived in small, cheap apartments in really vibrant, fun neighborhoods of New York City where, you know, our housing expenses were probably lower than a lot of people our age around the country, but I still felt like we had an amazing, you know, place to live. And so, it didn't feel like much of a sacrifice. And it did feel like building up building up a portfolio would just have a lot of value in the future, you know, for stability and, you know, peace of mind.
And are you guys from the city, or how'd you end up there? Just curious.
Neither of us are from New York originally, but we've been living here together since 2012. And my wife had been here, I guess, since 2011. And I had lived in New York kind of off and on a few years before that.
Okay. Got it. Okay. I think we laid some of the good groundwork here. So your final day, I believe, was February 28th. How long were you planning on stopping work and taking this break? And we'll just say retirement for shorthand, even though it's a sabbatical, sure, or whatever. So how long were you leading up to it? You had the numbers, you had the spreadsheets, you knew what was coming. When did you make that decision?
Kind of had it in the back of my mind for a while. You know, I mentioned I first read that, you know, Mr. Money Mustache piece back in 2014, a piece about him, not by him. You know, and then I did start reading, you know, his blog and worked my way through the whole thing. You know, reading it mostly on my subway commutes. Love the blog. I think there's a lot of value there. But of course, after hundreds and hundreds of pieces, there's a fair amount of repetition to it. And so sometimes I'd be sitting there reading kind of the same themes in slightly different ways, and kind of sitting next to somebody reading the Bible or reading Psalms and feeling like we're all kind of like reading about our version of the future good life and, you know, how to get there. Anyway, I just always found that to be a funny parallel on the New York subway where, yeah, Everybody's reading something. But anyway, so, you know, I had that kind of in the back of my mind for a while, you know, because I did get into that blog probably about 2018, something like that. And then, you know, this year, there was just kind of a moment where I decided there's not going to be a better time to take a break. And I really felt ready for it and felt like whatever I go back to in the future, I'll be more excited about after having had a change of pace for a while. And so, you know, I offered my company 6 weeks notice when I told them I was leaving. They took me up on that. And then I also consulted with them for a short period after. So I guess that would have been January that I was letting them know this was coming, and continued, you know, full time till the end of February with a bit of consulting beyond that.
Got it. Small tangent here. I was a bad employee-ish. And whenever I hear people say they gave 6 weeks, or they're like, I'm giving them 2 months or whatever, this long notice, I'm always a little bit appalled is too strong of a word. Because y'all are just trying to you're trying to be nice to the other folks and whatever. But the thing is, like, if they lay you off, sometimes they just kick your ass out the door, right? They'll probably give you 2 weeks. If you're lucky, you get a longer package, something like that. But the point being is they don't give any employees preferential treatment. They tell you to get the hell out and then you got to go. So I'm always curious why people give 6 weeks. And I wonder if now you have other thoughts around it.
My company was relatively small. I was the managing director of the division that I worked on. I definitely felt some responsibility for wanting to give my CEO the opportunity to really think about, you know, whether he wants to replace me kind of a one-to-one hire, how he'll want to delegate some of what I was doing to existing employees. You know, and it's also a place where they have really tried to do right by people if they were being laid off. Not necessarily to everybody, but at least in some cases. So yeah, I felt like important to preserve that relationship. And I genuinely wish them all the best. You know, I'm a shareholder in the company and want the mission to succeed, want the company to succeed. I just felt like it was time for me to step away.
That's a great answer. I take everything back, at least in your situation.
Well, I've heard you speak about your situation on past shows. It's just very different circumstance.
And I think we'll move on quick, but basically at very big companies, like I can see it makes more sense to me to just give the 2 weeks, or at a company where they railroad, even a smaller company where they railroad the employees. And maybe we've seen other times where someone gave 2 months and then the company did nothing to actually like take advantage of that. They just like ran the person into the ground. And then they left, and it's like, yeah, that person should have given 2 weeks. But in your situation, David, perfect sense. You laid it out very well. So, okay. You finished. You had your last day. It sounded like you did a little consulting, but things were turbulent in the market. So we're getting to the point. Things were turbulent in the market, and no one knew what was going to happen. So can you describe the first few weeks as you transitioned out of work, knowing that your wife couldn't cover all the expenses and you would have to be making some moves, whether it was like selling a little bit for covering the delta, but what did it feel like? What did it feel like those first few weeks where you were like, oh shoot, this is a rough time?
Yeah. I think it was the first business day of March of this year. I guess it was March 3rd, I think it would have been. I think the market went down maybe like point and a half, maybe 2 points, something like that. I don't remember exactly, but it was a rocky day. And that was my first day out of full-time employment. And then, you know, and then it kind of bounced up and down a bit for the next few weeks. No dramatic sustained losses, but some rough days in there followed by, you know, recoveries. And so, yeah, there was a sense, of course, of the sequence of returns risk is always there. With that said, this is not a situation where it's, you know, hey, there's zero income coming in. We budgeted for exactly 0.15% and we're going to take every penny out that we were planning on withdrawing much lower. So it wasn't that like, oh, I was planning on taking out 2% and now it's going to be 2.1. It wasn't concern about that so much, but it all does just feel a bit different, of course, when you don't also have the income completely covering expenses.
And you have been following the markets and investing and all that for at least a decade, probably much longer. Like, did you start investing as soon as you got a job in your 401k and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So I'd say, yeah, at least 15 years of following it.
Okay. So you've seen like some ups and downs and some really rough days. And we see it in A Simple Path to Wealth, J.L. Collins, or other blogs and mentioned all over the place where, like, we know there's going to be some ups and downs. In fact, if you look a little deeper, and I think you probably know as well, David, like every, what, like 3 years or so, there's probably going to be like a 10% drop. When you go out to like 10 years, I mean, it could be like a 40 or 50% drop. Like if you look historically, it may happen. Like we haven't seen that in the last 15 years, you know, and I don't know if we haven't, but I don't think we have. The point being, like, you knew that there was potential for this. So you mentioned in the email, like, you felt like this time was a little bit different. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. And look, ultimately, this is a, you know, somewhat speculative answer revolving around market timing. And of course, in a clinical way, I can say that that's not how you're supposed to do any of this, right? I know that. But nevertheless, you know, certain moments can feel a little bit different and can feel particularly scary. And it just felt like there were several factors at play that, frankly, are still at play. But between years of market surging, so potentially stocks already being overvalued, I say potentially because I don't know, certainly values are high. And then, you know, just all the uncertainty around trade and tariffs and what that all means. And if any kind of big event like that, there's the stuff that people can list as the expected effects, but then there's going to be other stuff that's not predicted and that you don't know. And that can go in either direction. You know, there could be some reasons that markets end up loving the changes that have happened and continue to happen for reasons that nobody's writing or talking about right now. But of course, it can also go in the other direction. And so, you know, I just had to decide. And also, I should say at this time, about 90-92% maybe percent in U.S. stocks. So heavy exposure to the U.S. market. You know, and I had to decide if that was a wise position to continue to hold on to.
In your email, one thing that I really liked, you laid out the situation of like what happened, and then you gave a few different ways to look at it, different perspectives, which I think are completely valid. And I'll let you list these out. I don't know if you could rattle them off the top of your head. And you could pause for a second if you want to pull up the email too.
I guess we should, because we've been talking about the market being a bit rocky. But when I really decided to go for it and make a sale was when it was beyond rocky. It was dropping whatever it was, 2 to 3 points a day for several days in a row, right? So we're getting from March into early April here. Yeah, that's when I decided to pull out a little bit. And then looking at it, because of course, as I'm sure listeners know, almost every day since that early April low has been pretty solidly up, you know, almost a full recovery from that drop, starting to get back towards, you know, all-time highs. And so of course it's, you know, it's hard to watch that knowing that I'm only sharing in a portion of that recovery, as opposed to had I done nothing, you know, would have been much more substantial. It's hard to know exactly how to feel about all of that, right? Because on the one hand, the investments that I sold, I had held for a long time, right? So I was selling them at a meaningful gain, right? If 5, 10, even 3 years ago, you told me, you know, I was going to sell a chunk and here's what the gain would be on it, I'd say, great, you know, sign me up. That sounds good. But still in the moment, it's hard not to peg your thinking to the all-time high of a couple months before. Is this simply a overdue diversification that is a wise and conservative, not even that conservative, but slightly more conservative thing to do? Is that loss simply money that I spent on gaining some independence from the fluctuation of the market for a bit more peace of mind? Is this just a silly, you know, screw up based on market timing? Or, you know, is it an insurance policy against whatever the next thing is that could happen, which could happen tomorrow or could happen years from now? And, you know, the bottom that it hits at that point, you know, will be much higher than now. And I wish I had been in the whole time, but you just never know with this stuff. And so it's hard to find that balance point, especially after a more exposed and risky portfolio had just been paying off year after year, really for my entire investment history.
Right. Like I said, I think you had a really good outlook on this because there's a couple things that you mentioned. You were 90% in US stocks roughly. And there is a lot of talk. Actually, several of my friends, I think, you know what, I can't remember who, but several of my friends are like, I'm 100% equities. I don't need bonds. And I think when you're looking at the maximum return, I think that does like play out over the long term. In many cases, people have oversaved and they're not in the position that you're in, David, where you actually, you need to have some like things that will help level off the volatility of 90% US stocks. And you know, when I think about it, of course, like all the shows, it's not financial advice at all. So consult your professionals out there. But when you're approaching retirement, often you need to either have a bucket of cash, right? Because a recession potentially could last a few months, but probably like 2 or 3 years. And if you don't have like some way to address the downturn, then you're going to be selling and it could fuck up your sequence of returns and all that kind of stuff that we know is a risk out there. So as you mentioned, like it sounds like you didn't have the, you know, a big bucket of cash out there. You probably had like a normal emergency fund or something, like 6 months or something like that, maybe.
Honestly, no. I never felt the need for that. I viewed it, and I think that this is still right. Like I think I still stand by that in terms of any actual emergency, like everything's liquid. We always had something in checking. We have credit cards. Like there's no cash that I would need this afternoon that I couldn't access, right? So in terms of actual like acute emergency, that was always fine. In terms of the longer term, there's a downturn piece. I always felt like, sure, there's that risk of, you know, selling some that you need to cover expenses right now, which is not really what I'm talking about big picture here. I sold way beyond immediate expense covering, but I always felt like, sure, that's a risk, that's a possibility, but you're locking in to keep whatever it is 6 months in cash. You're just locking in, you know, missing out on returns for that, which, you know, is its own risk. And so I was always more comfortable with potentially selling being off a high rather, you know, should we need to for an actual acute emergency, rather than, you know, sitting on a chunk that, you know, is not needed for something that could happen today. As you said, this also is not advice, of course, but I know that the standard advice is to keep that, but it didn't seem necessary given, you know, how liquid everything was and how accessible it was, should it actually be needed. And sure, maybe you're selling after something comes down 5, 10, 20%, but it comes down 5, 10, 20% after having grown for years and years. And so it's still a bigger pile than it would have been, you know, sitting in a checking account.
Right. It's an interesting conversation because, like, I get what you're saying. I listen to the Morgan Housel podcast pretty often, and he talks about, like, they paid off their house, so there's no mortgage. And then you listen to a show, some too.
Yep.
So you know this as well. And he keeps like way more cash than he needs, and in air quotes, I think that's exactly what he says. And I think it's like 20, 25% of his net worth or something. It's like a pretty large amount of money, like a surprising amount. And my wife, Elizabeth, she would, I mean, I think since we've met, like she always had way more in her checking account than would make sense. At this point, it's stayed relatively static, but it's still a pretty large, like it's over 1 year of expenses, right? So now that our net worth has grown, it, like percentage wise, it's smaller, but it's still a good chunk. For her, it gives that extra security that she's happy to give up, like instead of returns. So it's like she's willing to give up the returns over having that security. So it's just like people's brains work differently. And like, she feels better about that. And you feel better about like, yeah, you're right. Like we had such a great run. I mean, yeah, you sold it in quotes, like the bottom of the market. And by the way, we'll recap. So you sold 1/3 of your portfolio, basically at the bottom of our little dip here earlier this year in 2025. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And who knows if there could be a new bottom coming, of course, you know, by this time this goes out. But yeah, it was at the very bottom of that dip. And, you know, actually within minutes of selling, the market went from being down 3% that day to being up 3%. I mean, we're talking literally, I click sell and I go back and I look at the market and it's gone up 6% since I clicked. And then of course, continued to fluctuate from there before more steadily going back up. But yeah, so it was comically bad timing. It was one of those things where for the people listening, thinking like, oh, you panicked and made a market timing mistake, which is one valid interpretation of it. It's like, yeah, and it was about as bad as it could have been, right? I mean, you write the example of, you know, how bad it's going to be, and it's not as bad as it was. But still, the question is, long-term, was it really such a bad thing to do? Or does it make sense to move to this more traditional kind of 60-40, 70-30 type of split? Is that just a wiser long-term position, especially having just made the move to less work, right? Because of course, it's one thing to be 90% in equities when everybody's working. It's a different thing when you're not. So I don't regret not having the emergency fund through most of that time. On the other hand, maybe I just would have felt less exposed and then wouldn't have made that so. But I might not have, because again, it wasn't about like, oh, you know, I need to do this to reserve cash to pay my bills. It was about really just rethinking an orientation to the portfolio.
So you sold, and just curious. So many of the listeners out there might have like a brokerage post-tax account, 401k, they'll have a Roth, some other buckets. Can you describe like your buckets and then from where you sold? And then, yeah, well, I'll leave it at that. So what did it look like when you sold?
Yeah, so it was mostly out of a taxable brokerage account. So just because my age, that's the one that I can access without complication if I want to and need to. So yeah, so I do have 401k. My wife has 403b. We have Roths, kind of everything, but also have the taxable brokerage.
And then, so you sold. Where is the money now? What did you do with it? And what is the plan?
The first part of that question is easy. The second part, not so much. You know, I put it all right into a money market account, which, you know, these days is paying over 4%. The last time I had anything in a money market account, I think it was back in maybe 2017, when it was like less than 1%, right around 1%. So very different scenario. That kind of pays me, you know, monthly, you know, small but monthly paychecks, which goes a good way to closing the delta between our expenses and my wife's income. But with that said, again, it's more than we need if I'm thinking about it as like an emergency fund or something like that. So yeah, the question is, in my head is, you know, should I just continue to be in this kind of position because it gives me some space from volatility, gives me some buffer? Should I be looking for opportunities to go back in, whether that's if there's more bad news and I see drops, or also potentially just looking for other types of investment opportunities? You know, we don't own a home or any real estate. We don't really own anything. We live in New York, rent our apartment. We don't need a car. Big part of me loves not owning anything. I feel like my life is kind of busy enough without the responsibilities of owning other stuff. Yeah, different types of investment opportunities, or getting lucky on a drop, or just at some point deciding that I need to swallow the medicine and just get back into more conventional index funds after having sat out a period of time.
Yeah, that is a tougher one, because it does, like, I mean, you have to look at your philosophy on like your emergency fund, for example. Like, you're like, maybe we don't really need an emergency fund in the same way that other people might think about it. And yeah, like, do you go a little bit more into bonds? I'm actually, in a very minor way, I am like reallocating to some international stocks, very small amount, but like actually your situation, I need to sell a small amount of my post-tax brokerage account to cover some expenses. And I sell a little bit more than I need, and then I'll reallocate just a little bit over to the international. And honestly, like, if I look at the numbers, unless I do this like over the next, which I might do, but unless I do this over the next several years, it's going to be an inconsequential amount, and it probably won't really matter. And in fact, I was going to say, like, when we chatted for the pre-interview a few days ago, I was like, yeah, like, when you read this, and it's still fresh, right? But when I read the description, I'm like, oh shit, like, I would feel, yeah, you know what? That's rough timing. Like you said, even if you were writing a scenario, this is as rough as it can get. But in like 10 years, it's probably like, it probably won't even matter. Like, if you look at the actual change, don't look too hard, you know, compound interest and everything, but like, it'll be fine. And you moved it over, you're getting 4%. It's covering most of your cost that you need to take care of. I lost my train of thought. I don't even know what point I was trying to make now, but.
Yeah. I think it was just kind of that speculation about the future and what I should do from here. Should I sit tight with a bigger position in a money market, or, you know, what am I sitting tight for, is kind of becomes the question. Is it just for that security? Because, hey, look, if I look at the market today and it's down a few points, it doesn't hurt at all. In fact, it makes me feel like, oh, good, like my opportunity to buy is coming back. And like, that's a good thing. On the other hand, when it's up 2 points, I feel like I'm missing out a bit, even though I'm enough in there that, you know, most advisors, I think, would say like, yeah, that's a great place to be.
Like I said, it does get into sort of like the philosophical portfolio and like what you want to do. And I know, you know, at this point, I have some friends that have been retired for a few years and they have more money than they expected because of all the great returns over the last several years and their hard work too. But they will sometimes mention they have like 2 or 3 years of expenses. So if there's ever a downturn, they literally could just stop selling and basically live off that cash, which it seems like a huge amount, but at some point, I mean, I understand like they're removing all these variables and they're like, I know I'm going to be fine. I don't have to like take these losses if I don't want to, or if so, at least it softens the blow. So it's a smaller amount. And I'll give a plug. I'm wearing a Nectarine t-shirt here. Nectarine is a company, basically it hooks you up, hooks not you specifically, but it hooks a person up with advisors, and it's flat fee. They just give investing advice. It's not assets under management, which many people don't really like. Basically, it's $150 to $300 an hour, no strings attached. So in that case, and I mean, the thing is, like, when you're accumulating, I think you invest over the long term, like that's fairly straightforward. However, as we're finding, when you're approaching like retirement, you may want to either set aside some buckets or get someone to take a look at it. And then at least like in this case, David, perhaps you could have had a plan where it's like, okay, like I don't want to diversify outside of stocks. I like this, you know, 90%. That's cool. But what is your plan if the market drops by 10%, will you sit it out? Will you sell? Like, at least you think about it ahead of time. And I am an affiliate for Nectarine, so we'll put a link. And if you want to check it out, like Mile High Fi gets a commission. I don't remember how much it is, but it's some smaller portion of it. I'm curious, David, did you have like did you think it out like that, where you're like, I have a plan for what we will do if, but you know, X scenario happens? Contingencies.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is not the first downturn that I've been through, right? I mean, just a few years ago in 2022, we ended up going down, you know, relatively slowly. It wasn't a sharp drop, but got into a bear market there. It took a while to recover. I continued to, you know, invest through that period, sold nothing. So yeah, I've never sold before due to a drop. If I had been relatively comfortable, and there's one never knows what's coming, so it kind of feels weird to say, but if in my head I'd felt like, you know, in April, we took this 20% hit, but, you know, probably not going to get that much worse, I don't think I would have done anything. It was more just that sense that, again, it's still there of, you know, just tremendous unknowns in terms of what's happening with global trade and what its impact will be on the U.S. economy. While the markets have been back up, it doesn't mean that we're out of the woods on those concerns yet. And so, yeah, certainly at that moment, and it wasn't a completely panic moment of selling. You know, I discussed it with my wife. We were both on board. I think we talked about it over a weekend, and then it was Monday that we sold a bit. But yeah, I mean, in the moment, we were really just thinking about it primarily as an insurance policy against the potential ongoing drops that we could see. That is in some ways a nice way of saying market timing, but it's also a way of saying diversification and choosing to diversify in that moment because of, you know, legitimate concerns about what's going on. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that we had this plan, you know, written out for years of if this happens, then this will happen. You know, it felt like this volatility was due to very acute reasons. And so in that moment, it felt like being a little bit shielded from all that would help us relax a little bit in ways that we hadn't kind of needed you know, that relief from the volatility in the past. This time it just felt different. And yeah. And so that's why we behave differently.
I got a couple more questions here. One is just what your life is like now that you're not working. We'll come to that in a second, but I'm curious, like, either what advice would you give, say, like, yourself a year ago, or maybe, you know, a younger family member, and you're like, I went through this thing, everything worked out okay, but here's the advice that I would give to someone else. So what is your advice, knowing what you know now?
I think my advice, and I did know this to some extent, but just to don't be attached to what the number is in this moment, or to an expectation that what has been happening will continue to happen. This is an unpredictable world. And, you know, it's one thing to know that intellectually, it's a different thing to actually experience it. Don't beat yourself up if you make a decision and it's not ultimately, you know, maximizing what happens in terms of that number in your spreadsheet. You know, you mentioned Morgan Housel earlier, who speaks quite publicly about keeping a large cash position. And he always emphasizes, look, this is not ultimately a financial strategy. This is not my strategy to make the most money over the course of my lifetime. It's a strategy for peace of mind. I guess on some level, you have to accept that that comes at a cost. That comes at the cost of missing out on some returns. You know, that was a bit more acute with the timing that I had, but not necessarily any worse than it would have been if I had just kind of slowly built up a 30% or 40%, you know, bond position over the past 10 years or something. Probably still better off than if I had done that. You're going to make quote unquote mistakes. That's okay. You got to stick with it.
You bring up a really good point there, where the returns have been so good over the last few years that even if you, let's say you throw the, you know, roughly one third into bonds now, you may still be better off taking the 5% hit, just because bonds have not returned very much over the last few years. And if you would have slowly like taken that position, I'm pretty sure if you do the math, like, you're better off now just doing it that way, even though the timing hurts, especially psychologically. And I thanked you before. Thanks for sharing the story, because like, people don't want to share, in air quotes, a mistake. But now that we're talking it through, it's just like, it was probably not the optimal time to do it, but it's not the worst thing in the world. In a few years, it's probably not going to make a huge difference. I also think about, we had a house up in Bozeman and we sold it in 2019 when we moved down to Longmont. And I thought about keeping it and potentially renting it out. Real estate went up in value all over the country. Bozeman had a lot of people move there over the COVID timeframe. I think the place like doubled in value roughly. So I had looked back and I'm like, that sucks that I did not keep the place. But I talked to Carl one time and he was like, you know what? I mean, stocks have gone up so much. Like, what'd you do with the money? Yeah, I put it directly into VTSAX. So there's a strong chance that I came out ahead anyway. Number one, I didn't have to like try to manage a rental, and things always go wrong, right? I mean, like, owning a house is a lifestyle and it works well for us. And I like to have all my stuff or whatever, but the place in Bozeman had like the basement or the crawl space would flood, and the furnace and actually there was no AC. The furnace was in the crawl space, and like the one time that I caught it before it hit, it was like 1 inch away from like covering the furnace with water. Anyway, a house can be really expensive. And even if there were great returns and I was earning money and blah, 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 and it's opportunity cost. And at the end of the day, I'm lazy, as many people know. And I'm like, I don't want to like have to figure out how to solve this flooded. I think they built the house over a spring. It was really weird. I mean, just water would come up whenever the mountains would thaw. So anyway, I think you're going to be fine. Okay. You stopped working. What's it like? Are you bored? Are you like, I want to go back to work? How's everything going?
It's been wonderful. I'm 3 months into it. I mentioned a couple of times that I have kids, right? So I have young kids, a one-year-old and a five-year-old. I'm busy just with that, right? My wife and I, you know, between just getting up in the morning, making lunch, feeding the kids, getting them dressed, getting them out, they're going to school, they're in childcare for that chunk of the day. And then, you know, there's the evening, dinner, playtime, bath, bed, et cetera. So like that itself fills a lot of my time. It structures my days. It's just a very different situation than somebody who is single or doesn't have kids or and has this just kind of amazing expanse of time open to them. I have a midday, midweek, much smaller expanse of time. But with that said, that's been wonderful time. Enjoying doing things around the city that I just haven't had time for in the past, going back to old neighborhoods where I used to live and, you know, eating in, you know, the old lunch place that I loved and going to museums and stuff like that, exercising more. You know, I live very close to a beautiful park here. It's one of the best places to go for a run. And I get to do that anytime I want, as long as it's midday, Monday through Friday. Really enjoying the time. I've not felt bored at all. I may well get there, but you know, I'm only a couple months into this, you know, after more than 10 years at the same job and, you know, of course working before that as well. So yeah, it's been a great luxury and very happy to be at the place that I am right now.
Perfect. Yeah, good to hear. Like you said, with kids, they could take up a pretty decent amount of time. I don't have kids, but I am aware, especially young kids, they need all the attention that you can give them. It sounded like you were able to do some like things that you didn't have as much time. So maybe you could like run more and exercise more. And like you said, spend time around the city. Just curious if there's any other hobbies or things that you're able to pick up again, because now you have a little bit more time.
Nothing super concrete. I like to meditate and I do that a bit more. I like to read, but I feel like I can only do good reading actual books like when I have energy. I can read a page before I fall asleep or something, but after a day of work and childcare, I'm not ready to really engage with a book. I've been reading much more because I have some energy and space in my days. So yeah, no, I haven't taken on anything brand new during this period, but I've been doing more of the stuff that I already knew I like and enjoy and have always been doing when I could, but now I get to do more of it.
Very good. All right. I think we covered everything that we wanted to go over, but is there anything that I missed, David?
No, I don't think so. It's been a good conversation, good to kind of process this issue. I know that I'm not the only one out there thinking through this kind of a thing and in this moment, and you know, and there may well be more to come in terms of the volatility and whatnot. And so more and more people will have these kind of decisions in front of them.
And you're not on social media, you're under the radar. And you did mention you would be willing to share your email. So I'll put it in the show notes. I don't know, I'll make it so people will be able to email you, but not so spammers can scrape your email. So if people want to reach out to you, it's okay if they shoot you an email. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also on LinkedIn. You know, I do have other social accounts, but I rarely look at them. So yeah, best way to contact me for any reason would be email.
All right. Cool. Well, great chatting with you. And I'm sure it'll all work out fine. And I'm glad that you're enjoying not working. It's one of the best things. It's not working.
It's been great.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast. And I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. All right, David. So I recently got into like not credit card hacking, but like the points game a little bit. In a lot of ways, I'm like, I just don't want to be hassled. But every now and then, I know there's like some great bonuses to the point where like I got like the Chase Sapphire. And then there was a bonus where I think it ran for about a month or two, and it was like 100,000 point bonus. So I actually like referred my wife after I already had the card, and she was super resistant, but she was like, fine, I'll do it. And she cannot wait to close the card for some reason. It's just like short circuiting her brain or something like that. Not that she doesn't understand, but she just doesn't, she doesn't like that for some reason. So anyway, do you get into credit card points and stuff?
I do. Yeah. I don't always use the points in the most efficient way, but I will happily take a bonus when they want to give it to me.
All right. So do you get like new cards very frequently? Like what's the situation? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, honestly, I view it as some of the easiest money that's out there on a, like an hourly basis. It's some very light admin that pays very well. So yeah, keep a little spreadsheet, keep track of what I've got going and what I need to do. And I often do, if it's got an annual fee, I do close it, you know, after getting the bonus. But yeah, no, I think it's a good opportunity.
Cool. So what is the sort of interval? How many cards do you get per year? And do you get your wife involved? You're like, hey, get this card. And then like say, hey, use this for whatever, like restaurants, or use it at the grocery.
I do. And she has no interest in doing any of it independently, but is like perfectly happy to be like, oh, okay, this is my card now. Sure. So as long as I'm the one who keeps track of it and all that, yeah, she's game to participate. So yeah, we can always double up in that way.
Got it. And how many cards do you have like right now? Does it get complicated where you're like, I don't know which card to use, or you're organized enough to make it easy?
It's pretty easy. Also, just like for myself personally, this is a very expensive time of life, two very young kids. So it's never hard to hit the initial, you know, spend. I hope that won't always be the case. But right now, yeah, it's very quick in terms of putting a few, whatever, childcare invoices on there or something. You hit your spend and then you can just forget about it. So it doesn't take a lot of mental bandwidth. You just got to keep track of it. In terms of how many cards, I mean, I generally don't close accounts unless they have an annual fee. So I've got a lot of open ones, you know, in part just because I've had more time to think about it. Like last year, I think we did very few, you know, so busy, but with the extra time, it's a small kind of side hustle that's well worth the investment.
The thing that you mentioned before, like, I don't always like redeem them for the optimal value, which I think can be challenging, because I've definitely talked to some folks and they're like, I have 300,000 points of, I could be mixing it up, but I think Capital One, because a lot of people enjoy, like, is it the Venture? I forget the name of the card, but there's like a great Capital One travel card, but I don't think you can transfer points as easily as Chase. So people are sitting on like hundreds of thousands of points, which should potentially be like several hundred or thousands of dollars of like value, but they're unable to redeem it very well. So how do you deal with that?
So, I mean, usually I just redeem it for cash, you know, a statement credit. So
yeah,
usually, you know, that's the simple route. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to plan. Occasionally, you know, as I said, with a little more time and a little more bandwidth to think about it, some of the recent ones I have, you know, used towards expenses I was going to use anyway, but like travel expenses, stuff like that, where, you know, you're getting an extra, whatever, 25% value or something. I'm always happy to get the extra 25% as long as it's not overcomplicating things, right?
Right.
You know, I had one where I put it in to my like Uber app, and that's the one I just use on my Uber app. And once my points are gone, I'll probably switch it to something else, get the extra 20% by using it on a travel expense.
Got it. Yeah. And I think I know when I mentioned that to a couple people, I'm like, I just redeemed it for cash. They're like, oh, that's the dumbest thing you can do. Which I like, the thing is, like, if you sit on it for too long, it'll lose its value anyway. And I have been guilty in the past where I had like, whatever, over 100,000 points. And I just sat on it for like 6 years or whatever. It's like, okay, probably better off to get the cash value. And then you could do something else. Like, it goes away over, or the value does deteriorate over time and they change the point. Anyway,
yeah.
Hopefully people don't come after you.